In a world of Democrats,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
And Republicans,
I've abandoned free market principles to save the free market system.
You need a voice of liberty. Look no further. You found it. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody, to the Tom Woods Show, episode 298. I'm titling today's episode, Income Inequality, Non-Solutions to a Non-Problem. Provocative, yes, but necessary. And I'm going to go through this topic with the help of an article I came across just a few days ago, even though it was published originally in 1994. Robert Higgs, who's been a guest on this program a couple times in the past, is the author of the article, and he made mention of it not too long ago on the blog of the Independent Institute, saying that the principles of this article still hold true, even if some of the statistics might be out of date 20 years later. So I wanted to go through it with you guys, offering some of my own commentary on it. The article is called 19 Neglected Consequences of Income Redistribution. And of course, one of the purposes of income redistribution is to alleviate so-called income inequality. So that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, there's a lot to say about income inequality that I won't be saying here today. We've got several episodes of this show in which we've discussed income inequality. We have the episodes with Diana Furchgott-Roth. We've got an episode with George Reisman that talks about this, and an episode with Deirdre McCloskey. In the show notes for today's episode, I will include links to those episodes, which go into more detail on the statistics, the often misleading statistics regarding income inequality. So check those out. The show notes page for this episode is tomwoods.com/298, because this is episode 298. Let me interrupt myself for a moment. Those of you listening on YouTube or who are listening to me for the first time, you might want to just skip over the next couple of minutes, but I do want to let the regular listeners know something about what's been going on with the show and with my website. Longtime listeners will know that it was Peter Schiff who initially set up a page on his site for me to use for my podcast, and that worked very well for a long time. But there were severe limitations on that page, and eventually I decided it was just awkward anyway, having two separate sites, my own website, tomwoods.com, and then having to direct people over to a show site where there wasn't really space for show notes for the episodes. And I just didn't like it. So we finally consolidated the two places, and now you get the show from tomwoods.com. That's where you get them. You don't go to that old Schiff radio page. You get them from tomwoods.com. tomwoods.com/podcast is where all the episodes are, but you can easily find your way around at tomwoods.com, and it's much better. The show notes are robust and detailed and just what you want, full of all the resources that were discussed in that day's episode. So you can always head over to the show notes. You can use the URL I give you, tomwoods.com/, and then I'll give you some number. So we started this a couple days ago with episode 296, and it makes it a lot easier for you, the listener, to remember what books we talked about or what articles we were talking about or whatever it is, some video we want you to watch. All that stuff will be there on the show notes page for each episode. The entire list of episodes that we've done, nearing 300 now, you can find at tomwoods.com/episodes. Now, in the course of making this transition to tomwoods.com, well, invariably you run into problems. And we briefly had an interruption of the iTunes feed, and Stitcher was completely wacky for about 12 hours at least. But they seem to be more or less back to normal. On iTunes, we need to fix the show graphic and the show description. That should be done within the next few days. The descriptions of the episodes have to be restored. I mean, there are some issues, but it's basically back up and running. You can subscribe. You can be getting the episodes automatically. So do please do that. You can do that now at tomwoods.com. I hope you'll agree with me. The new site is vastly superior to the old arrangement of having things in two different places. And also, it's vastly superior to the old tomwoods.com. Now, back to our subject. On the question of why this is a non-problem, I would refer you primarily to the show we did with Deirdre McCloskey, where she's talking about trends over the course of a couple of hundred years of world history, trends in which the poorest in the world have seen their incomes and material standard of living increased so dramatically that nothing in history can remotely compare to it, to the point where inequality, so-called today, is such a tiny footnote to this enormous story of progress as to be utterly negligible and uninteresting. So I would direct you there. I mean, there's a lot more that can be said. The Furchtgott-Roth stuff is also very good. But I want to get into this Bob Higgs article. He points out, first of all, that a lot of times we think that when government redistributes income, it's taking income from rich people and giving it to poor people. And this, for some people, this really satisfies them, that the government does this. But he says, first of all, that's not even true. He says 85%, more than 85% of all government transfer programs is not means tested. So in other words, it's not money that goes just to people who are poor. It goes to anybody. It can go to anybody. So, for example, the biggest share of all this goes to the elderly in the form of pensions and Medicare benefits. Well, anybody who's over 65 can get those benefits, whether they're multimillionaires or whether they, you know, have $500 in their bank accounts. So there's no means testing there. That is not a question of the rich are being taxed to pay the poor. To the contrary, generally the poor are being taxed to pay the well-off, because that's actually the age bracket, 65 and above, that is the highest in the United States. Those are the people who have the highest income per person, the highest wealth per person of any age group. We can also note the same kind of phenomenon when we're talking about farm programs. There you have federal money, the vast bulk of which goes to a small sliver of the largest farms. All right, let's go through the neglected consequences of income redistribution. Now, you sticklers, by the way, who listen to this program a lot, will know that it's not really redistribution when the government violently seizes somebody's property and gives it to somebody else. It's just distribution. Redistribution implies that there was some distribution, and then there's a redistribution. But on the free market, there is no distribution. There's just people buying and selling. There's just people voluntarily parting with property, voluntarily exchanging property, voluntarily entering into contracts with people. There is no mechanism of distribution in any of that. So the incomes that people have and the wealth that people have in a market economy, these things are not the result of distribution, and then the government redistributes the stuff. There is no distribution. There's just exchanges. So really, we're talking about distribution of income, not redistribution, but that's for the sticklers who were going to email to remind me about this, so I thought I would preempt all that by acknowledging it from the outset. All right, number one, Higgs says, taxes for the purpose of income redistribution discourage the taxpayers from earning taxable income or raising the value of taxable property through investment. Well, this, I think, rings true for anybody. I mean, I work extremely hard. Like, I am just working nonstop to produce videos for the Ron Paul Homeschool Program, for example, at ronpaulhomeschool.com. And that is just murdering me. Like, every day I'm doing something on this. I've already made over 330 videos, and I've got about 250 or so more still to go. Well, that is killing me. I mean, that is absolutely, it's very interesting stuff, and it's very rewarding, and I'm glad I'm doing it. And right now I'm getting set to talk about the French Revolution and the Reign of Terror and Napoleon. It's all very interesting stuff. But combine that with a lot of the travel that I do all over the country, doing speaking and other events, and you combine that with all these other ventures that I have going, and if all of a sudden I found that for every additional dollar I'm losing 70 cents of it, or 90 cents of it, I wouldn't bother. I really wouldn't. I would just say, you know what, to heck with it. We're just going to have to live at a lower standard of living. The reward is not worth the effort. I'll just sit around and consume more leisure. Now, assuming there is some value to what I do, my not doing it anymore makes society poorer. All right, secondly, transfer payments discourage the recipients from earning income now and from investing in their potential to earn future income. People respond to a reduced cost of idleness by choosing to be idle more often. When they can get current income without earning it, they exert less effort to earn more. When they expect to get future income without earning it, they invest less in education, training, job experience, personal health, migration, and other forms of human capital that enhance their potential to earn income in the future. Hence, the society is even poorer both now and later than it would have been merely because taxes discourage current production and investment by the taxpayers who fund the transfers. I think that's fairly self-explanatory, as is the related point number three, that recipients of transfers tend to become less self-reliant and more dependent on government payments. When people can get support without exercising their own abilities to discover and respond to opportunities for earning income, those abilities atrophy. Well, this is true. This is clearly true. And if you don't see examples of people who have fallen into this trap, you're not looking around hard enough. It's absolutely everywhere. This one really is just common sense, that if you have less of an incentive to engage in the hard work that's necessary to improve your skills, to be alert to opportunities, you're going to do less of that. It's just a fact of human nature that people want to get their stuff with the least exertion possible. So the feedback in society has to push them in a healthy direction and not in the direction that the baser aspects of our nature want to take us, namely that we should hope that we can somehow support ourselves in ways other than through productive work and exertion and creativity, etc. Then, likewise related to this, number four, recipients of transfers set a bad example for others, including their children, other relatives, and friends, who see that one can receive goods, services, or money from the government without earning them. And so these people, too, adopt that kind of attitude. And again, I have seen this. I have seen children in households like this grow up to have an utterly juvenile attitude about wealth, money, wealth creation, dessert, etc. It cripples them forever. I have seen this again and again. There is absolutely nothing generous or charitable about putting people in that position. But that is, in fact, what the welfare state has done. Then number five, because some transfers are more generous than others, some classes of recipients come to resent the, quote, injustice of the distribution of the largesse. Hence arise political conflicts. And I've often called this a low-intensity civil war, that you have battles, political battles of old against young, black against white, rural against urban, female against male, whatever it is. Homeowners against renters, whatever it is. And the existence of the state and its ability to redistribute income provokes this outcome in which everybody organizes against everybody else. This is what happens when you have what Frederick Bastiat called legal plunder. And he said, you know, there are three ways you can organize society. You can have everybody plunders everybody else, some people plunder other people, or nobody plunders anybody. Now, if you advocate the third one, nobody plunders anybody, well, you get called an extremist and you're evil and you hate people and you hope they all die. But there are negative consequences to having everybody loot each other. It makes the whole society less productive because we're all spending our time looting instead of producing. It produces the wrong kind of attitude. It absolutely destroys the entrepreneurial spirit. And it dissolves the kind of community camaraderie that might otherwise exist between people. Of course, if you haven't already, you should read that little book by Frederick Bastiat. Bastiat lived in the first half of the 19th century. And the little book I have in mind is The Law. And I will put a link to that in the show notes as well, along with a link to the children's version. There's a children's book. I talked to Connor Boyack, the author of the Tuttle Twins series. And he has a book in which they're talking about the law, and they're learning that book. They're learning the lessons of that book. And it's a great book for children to read from, and also to start thinking about some interesting topics like this. Like, is it okay to just go and take people's things? Does it become okay if a whole bunch of people go and take those things? Or if a guy with a uniform and a badge and a fancy-looking hat goes and takes the things? That's the question. Number six is related to number five. Here we see that the taxpayers then fight back against all this, and there's all kinds of effort poured into fighting back against these transfer payments from the poor to the rich, and people organize against it. And then number seven, as a result of the preceding two consequences, the entire society grows more divided and pugnacious. Less and less does the society constitute a genuine community. Rather, it becomes balkanized into bellicose subgroups regarding one another as oppressors and oppressed. Then number eight, among the recipients of transfers, self-help institutions languish. Well, I don't think that's even remotely debatable. Like, we can see that in American history. We can see it, for example, in the work of David Beto, who wrote that book, From Mutual Aid to the Welfare State. We had David on this show last year. I'll put a link to that episode in the show notes. And I think it was something like Before the Welfare State, or What Did People Do Before the Welfare State? That was the name of the episode, something like that. So I'll put that there. There's no question about that, that if the government takes over these functions, then what's the point of having the private sector do anything? What's the point of having the voluntary sector do anything? What's the point of having volunteers do anything? And so, of course, when you ask the average person, well, what are you doing to help less fortunate people? The answer almost always is absolutely nothing. I'm not giving of myself in any way. I write out a check to some faceless institution that then sends other checks to people, and we think this is the most humane way for the less fortunate to be helped. But of course, it's the worst conceivable way for the less fortunate to be helped, because the institution helping them has no incentive whatsoever to improve their material condition. To the contrary, these institutions boast of how many people are on their rolls, not how many are off. They build entire empires based on these figures. Whereas in the private sector, in the voluntary sector, the sector that's not funded by a gun to the head and a gun in the ribs, they boast about how many lives they turned around, how many people were changed by coming through their programs. That's what you're looking for as a donor. You're looking for how have lives been enriched and transformed by this institution. Well, these things are just going to close up shop if there's no reason for them to exist. Charles Murray develops this point in his book, In Pursuit of Happiness and Good Government. But also, as I say, that David Beto book is very important. So I'll link to those books in the show notes also. All right, number nine. Well, eight and nine are really related to each other, because eight really has to do with self-help institutions among the poor themselves, and then charitable institutions run by and funded by wealthier people. Both of these types of institutions tend to wither away and atrophy when the welfare state is created. Beto talks a lot about self-help groups, particularly the fraternal organizations in the United States, which were in some ways in their functions analogous to the English friendly societies. Then number 10 is more subtle. As citizens drop out of their involvement in charitable and helping institutions, letting the government take over, they become less self-directing and more accepting of all kinds of government activity. So when someone proposes that the government undertake a function previously carried out exclusively within the private sphere, people are not shocked. They're not even very suspicious of the government's ability to carry out the task. After all, governments now do all sorts of things, from socializing preschoolers to feeding the poor to ensuring the medical expenses of the elderly. So what if the government takes on still another responsibility? What was once a prevailing suspicion of the enlargement of government becomes a resignation to or an acceptance of its continuing expansion into new areas. Then number 11, hence people do not mobilize political opposition so readily when new government programs are proposed. Facing less opposition, those who support the new programs are more likely to triumph politically. New government programs proliferate quicker, restrained somewhat by budgetary limitations, but not much by fundamental ideological objections. Then in number 12, Bob Higgs reminds us that there are, after all, bureaucracies involved here. This is not just a question of one person pays and another person is paid. There's a middleman here that's going to take a portion of that money. Now, these bureaucracies don't produce anything of value to consumers. Consumers don't voluntarily support them. So they are a dead weight loss to society. These are people who could be producing goods and services. They could be improving the lives of people through voluntary means, increasing the amount of goods and services available in the economy. But instead, they're simply consuming resources and contributing nothing that anybody would be willing to pay for. So society is the poorer. And then, number 13, we all know that once you create some kind of government bureau, you never get rid of it. It doesn't matter what happens in the future. I mean, now there are a few exceptions to this. It's not apodictically true that all government bureaus last forever, but 99.9% of them last forever. They long outlive whatever their original purpose was because they come to be ends in themselves. They become fiefdoms for the people who are employed by them. And we see this, I mean, again, evidence is hardly necessary, although I talk about examples of this type of behavior in my 2011 book, Rollback, as just one of the 800,000 arguments against government that I put in there. Then, of course, there's the time and all the resources consumed in trying to deal with the tax code itself. And, of course, trying to minimize one's exposure to it. Now, of course, if you do manage to minimize your exposure to it, that's good for society in the long run. There'll be more wealth creation than there would otherwise have been, but not as much as there would have been if you hadn't had to go to all this trouble to keep the fruits of your labor, not have it violently confiscated by an entity that thinks it's entitled to a portion of your life, which is really what it's saying when it's saying that, yep, we are entitled to the fruits of 2 days' worth of your labor, is really the same thing as saying we're entitled to 2 days of your life every week. I mean, that I don't see how that's any different morally. And of course, that was the main argument that was being made by Robert Nisbet, I beg your pardon, by Robert Nozick, in his book Anarchy, State, and Utopia, when he was talking about his Tale of the Slave. But in any case, we're talking here about buying books, computer software, hiring lawyers, accountants, financial advisors. There are resources that have to go into tax resistance, ballot initiatives, and things of that sort. All these things consume resources as well, and likewise make society poorer. Compliance with the taxes, number 15. Compliance with the taxes costs resources. You got to keep records, you got to make sure you're up on the current tax rules, you got to fill out all the forms. I mean, this takes me a very long time, actually, because of how confusing all the different sources of income are. Now, when we combine this effect, that how costly it is to comply with the rules and how costly it is for the government to actually get the money, and then how resource-consuming the various government bureaus are, you put all that together, and the result is that if you want to get $1 to the poor through government, you have to give government $5 for just one to get to the poor. This is the institution that's going to change our lives and make everybody better off. But as I've shown in many, many places, to the contrary, it was the free market that did vastly more. I mean, it's not even close. Vastly more to bring about an alleviation of poverty all over the world. Long before there were welfare states, we saw that. Then, of course, people also devote resources not just to trying to evade or limit taxation, but to be on the receiving end of the redistribution. So, number 16, just as taxpayers do not passively submit to being taxed, recipients and potential recipients of transfers do not just sit quietly waiting for their ship to come in. They also act politically. They form organizations, attend meetings, employ publicists and lobbyists, and campaign for political candidates who support their objectives. So society is going to be poorer as the result of this type of activity as well. Likewise, number 17, if you are a recipient of these transfers, you have to employ resources to establish and maintain and prove your eligibility to receive them. So to prove that you are eligible for unemployment benefits, you've got to wait in long lines to show that you're unemployed. You've got to run around and pretend to apply for jobs you have no intention of taking. Or to prove that you're disabled, you've got to do this and that. These are other resources. 18. By adopting programs to redistribute substantial amounts of income, a nation guarantees that its government will become more powerful and invasive in other ways. And then he elaborates on this and then concludes with, when the government created Medicare and Medicaid in 1965, for example, it set in motion a train of events that led inexorably to the subsequent, quote, crisis of escalating health care costs, and thence to the bigger government now being wrought by congressional efforts to deal with this artificial crisis. In the show notes at tomwoods.com/298, I'll also link to episodes in which we've talked about health care and how we got to the position we're in today. And then finally, number 19, creating a more powerful and invasive government means that the liberties of citizens will be diminished. Rights previously enjoyed will be set aside. Then skipping a bit, he says, one person's welfare right entitles a corresponding duty of other people to provide the resources necessary to satisfy the claim. Now let me jump in here to correct a common error, by the way. There'll be some people who say, but these transfer payments give a boost to the economy because consumption is what drives the economy. Well, it isn't. That's a myth. It's a myth that the misleading GDP statistic feeds into. It makes you think that 70% of the economy is consumption, whatever that might mean. I'm going to link to the episode on GDP that we did to explain what's wrong with that, but just think of it this way. I mean, first of all, GDP leaves out all the intermediate stages that require saving to sustain. All the intermediate stages of production that are not counted in GDP, these are, so to speak, the warp and woof of the whole economy. And if you don't have enough gross saving to maintain those stages of production, society reverts to barbarism. Or think of it this way. Think of it this way. If consumption is the key thing, then we should all just consume. Right? If consumption is what creates jobs, supposedly, that's what people think, that I go out and buy some stuff and then that allows them to hire workers and all that. All right, well, what if the business firms themselves acted that way? What if they consumed everything they earned? Instead of saving it, plowing it back into the business, saving it for payroll, saving it for investment, suppose they just blew it all on fancy pictures for the storefront or fancy coats for the owners or whatever. Suppose they just went out and consumed all the money because they read in a newspaper that consumption is the way to go. Where would be the money for payrolls? Where would be the money to sustain the business? Those things happen by saving, not by consumption. If everybody, including the business firms, just consumed, there wouldn't be an economy. There wouldn't be a structure of production. But the point of all this is, once you start down the government road, there are so many consequences that are invisible to most people. But you put the sum total of all these together, and you're talking about serious declines in wealth, in standard of living, especially for the poor, and a serious deformation in society, in how society functions, how society should function, how we should interact with our fellow man. All that has changed, and not in good ways. All right, that's all I have to say about that. Check out tomwoods.com/298 for more information and for a link to this article that I've been commenting on and the resources that I've mentioned. Those will all be linked at tomwoods.com/298. I have a brand new book out. It's called Real Dissent, A Libertarian Sets Fire to the Index Card of Allowable Opinion. You can check that out at realdissent.com, and you can get a free copy of the audiobook version with me reading it at tomwoodsaudio.com. Tomorrow, David Stockman, formerly director of the Office of Management and Budget under Ronald Reagan, joins us once again to talk about the money printers around the world who are running out of ideas as economies continue to stall, and they just don't know what to do about it. That's tomorrow. Make sure and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher at TomWoods.com, and we'll see you then. Thanks for listening, everybody.
The Tom Woods Show.